Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Dr. Jennifer Harvey. Harvey is a writer, speaker, and professor of religion at Drake University. Her work focuses on racial justice and white anti-racism. Her analysis and commentary has appeared in many publications, including the New York Times and the Huffington Post. Dr. Harvey is author of several books, including her most recent, Raising White Kids, Bringing Up Children in a Racially Unjust America. It was published by Albingdon Press late last year, and it's what we'll be discussing on today's show. I'm talking to Jennifer Harvey by phone from her hotel in Minnesota. Jennifer Harvey, welcome to Out of Bounds.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
Let's begin by talking about the concept of race-conscious parenting. Tell us about that.
Well, race-conscious parenting is a shift, especially for parents of white children, where instead of doing what we sometimes think of as colorblind parenting or even just quote-unquote generic value equality parenting, we talk and teach our kids about difference, about race, we name it, we recognize it, but we also teach them from early ages about racism and racial injustice, so that we are not only teaching them about race and diversity and valuing that, but we're also teaching them that as white Americans, they have a role to play in anti-racism and in work for racial justice.
Yeah, yeah. You know, you said that American families often try to keep race differences out of their conversations with their children, but you think families should be talking openly about skin tone, physical differences. Talk to us more about that, and how does one do that?
Well, so it's important that we're specific. It's really white American families that don't do that. Lots of data suggests that families of color most do that, do it from very young ages. And so it's really a white silence that we're talking about.
Mm.
And some of the ways that we do it is, one, to really understand that at this point, people of color in this country have been very clear that they want their racial identities to be seen and honored and valued. And so we shouldn't even think colorblind parenting is something we should do, that we should be talking about difference. And so when our kids are very, very young, we should do it the same way we talk about all kinds of things. And so we should talk about, oh, look, that person has brown skin, and they may be African American, and this person has peach skin, and she looks like she's white American. And just sort of, just like we teach our children lots of things, make difference and naming race part of the conversation with really young kids. And from there, we then have the building blocks we need to start to point out to our children when they see and experience racism in the world, which our children do from very young ages.
Yeah.
And we create this running dialogue between white children and white parents that oftentimes doesn't yet exist in white families. And it helps us be partners with people of color in this country who are already talking about race with their children. It helps us start to do the heavy lifting we need to be doing as part of that larger collective work.
Yeah, yeah. Do you think the conversation should just be deliberate, or should they just be conversation that comes up, you know, while you're wandering around the house or taking your kid to school? Should it be formal, in other words?
I think it does have to be deliberate on the part of parents, because many, many white Americans live in such segregated enclaves that if we are not deliberate about initiating dialogue with our children, it's not necessarily going to just kind of, like, quote unquote, naturally come up.
Mm.
And again, especially if we live in predominantly white spaces, which many white Americans do, but it doesn't necessarily have to be formal. And so it doesn't have to mean that every time I talk about race with my child, I've got some lesson planned out. What our kids need from us as parents and caregivers is for us to demonstrate through our conversations and our behaviors that race is something that we can and we do talk about as a family. And what will happen in many contexts is that our kids, if they assume that we talk about race, right now lots of white children we know think that race isn't something we're supposed to talk about, even though they're experiencing it. If our kids know that we should talk about race and we do that as a family, they are going to then become more and more likely to bring us stories and experiences and ask us questions. And so if we're deliberate early and often, we sort of set our family up for open conversations about things that it's really urgent we talk about if we want to raise an anti-racist generation of white youth.
Yeah, yeah, it's so important in this culture. And it's often something that people just move away from and don't even want to pay attention to, which makes it worse, obviously.
Yes. There's a lot of white anxiety about talking about race.
Yes, yes.
And we have to move through that and just start doing it.
And you also, you talk about the fact that children actually understand about racism much earlier than their parents would assume.
Yes. We have so many studies that will show us that children as young as 3 and 4, all children, not just white children, have begun to internalize negative stereotypes about people of color and false superiority stereotypes about white people. They just pick that up from the environments that they live in, the social fabric of our nation. And we know that by the age of 5, children recognize that there are racial social statuses in our society. And so what happens is our kids are constantly, as they are with so many things in the world, interpreting, making sense of things that they see. And so if we have white children who are going into spaces where, they don't see black people in positions as doctors, they only have white doctors, or they don't see Latino people in positions as teachers, and they only have white teachers, they will start to interpret the reasons for that, and those reasons will almost every time conclude that, draw racist assumptions about communities of color. And so white parents need to know that, need to know how early our children are making sense out of the world so that we can give them the information that they need to make accurate interpretations about why it is that they see these various racial social statuses in the world.
Yeah, to me that's important in regard to almost anything in the world. You have to have somebody to interpret for children.
Yes, yes.
You also talked about how teaching kids that we are all the same, we're all human, does not work in this kind of context. So talk to us about that.
So it doesn't work to teach our kids that we're all just the same for the same reasons that colorblind parenting is not a respectful approach. People of color have said, I want you to see my race. I have particularities that I want to be celebrated and welcomed. And so that's one problem with just saying, oh, we're all the same. The other problem with it is that it's an abstract. We don't experience the world through sameness. We experience it through difference. And so we are teaching an important value that we all have innate dignity and we all have innate equality and we all are innately wonderful in our own human way. But what our kids can't do it without help is take that abstract teaching and actually apply it in the real world where they're experiencing injustice and seeing injustice constantly. And so what we've got to do is say, oh, yes, we are all innately equal and we have innate dignity, but the world isn't that way. And part of our job as people who care about equality is to participate in making a world in which everyone is treated equally. And so we have to sort of interpret that connection for our children. Just saying everybody's the same doesn't lead our kids to conclude, oh, and thus I need to be about anti-racism. They just conclude, well, if we're all the same and this community's not doing well, they must not be, working as hard as they need to work.
Because
otherwise they would do just as well as me. And so that's the missing piece in that sameness conversation.
And you see it. It's so blaring in so many communities. Now, on the other hand, you also talk about teaching white kids about racism. You want to be careful not to make them think kids of color are just victims, right?
Yes. Yeah, so we do have to teach white children about racism so they can recognize it when they see it. But yes, we have to be very careful not to end up primarily teaching our kids that African-American children or Latino communities, that their primary role in the world is to be the target of racism. And so thinking about being deliberate and being proactive, we need to make sure our kids have lots of diversity in their lives, that they do learn about racism. We actively talk about that. But they also have experiences where, people of color are just celebrating life, and they have books where they see kids of color just playing and being kids, and where it's not necessarily a book about fighting racism, and that we sort of really make a conscious, intentional effort to have as much possible diversity in our children's landscapes as possible, so that it's less likely that as we're teaching our kids about racism, which we have to do, it's less likely that they just sort of draw a one-dimensional picture of what it means to be African-American, for example.
Yeah.
And so it's, again, about being deliberate and really reaching beyond what just sort of naturally pops up in our very segregated worlds, and making sure we just have lots of different messages going on all the time, and keeping the conversation going so that if that does start to happen, we can interrupt it and redirect and go, oh, this is information I need to sort of, redirect my child in this way because I'm now hearing that he or she is drawing that conclusion.
Yeah, yeah. Well, what about the communities where white kids hardly ever meet black kids or African-American or Latina kids? How does one approach that kind of educational need for white children?
So one of the things that we need to do is, just like all white American families should be doing and need to be doing, getting race talk on board very, very early, lots of diverse engagements with books and media and all kinds of things. And I think one of the things that I imagine can happen in households where folks are living in communities where there is not much racial diversity is that, eventually the conversation can become, look, we're reading all these books where there's all these, different kinds of people and there's lots of people of color in these books. Why aren't there people of color in this neighborhood? Why aren't there people of color in this town? And as our kids get a little bit older, they might even start to ask us those questions. And so we can, we can and need to then use that sort of developmental moment to start teaching our kids about how it came to be that our neighborhood or our town is predominantly white. We need to teach our kids about local histories, and we can do that when they're a little bit older. And sometimes if we've done a good job of making sure that they see lots of diverse representation, even if in their actual living they're not in spaces where people of color are well represented, that sometimes maybe our kids will even ask us those questions. And so why is it that I see African-American people in all the books we read, but I never see African-American people in our city? And we sort of go there with our children and start to teach them truthful histories about how it is it came to be this way.
And that's where they learn the word segregation, right?
Yes. Yes. And our kids can learn that word early, and we need them to if they're going to end up being able to, for example, work against segregation in their own lives and in their own communities.
Yeah, yeah. Jennifer, talk to us a little bit about your own kids and what you've taught them and some examples.
Sure. So my kids at this point are 8 and 10. And some of the things I'm talking about, and I just want to say I'm certain I'm making lots of mistakes along the way, but just are practices that have emerged as I've tried to figure out in my own living as a parent what it means to bring anti-racism, which I'm committed to in my adult life in many different ways, into my family life. And so, for example, I have just always included the language of difference in my conversations with my children when they were very, very young. And there was a time, I think, when my older child was about 3 where we had a CD that had this song on it, and I talk about it as song number 19. It was the One Little, Two Little, Three Little Indian song, and it's a racist, colonialist song, and I didn't want her to hear it. And so my partner and I used to always hit skip on the CD player when that song was about to come on. But lo and behold, one day I heard my 3-year-old singing this song, and I thought, okay, I sort of panicked in the moment and was like, oh, stop it. But I didn't say that to her, fortunately. I kind of caught my breath, gave myself 3 or 4 hours to think about how I wanted to talk about it with her. And I decided at the age of 3 that I wasn't going to yet go into a conversation about dispossession or genocide, but that I said to her, hey, I want to talk about that song I heard you singing, and I want to tell you that I don't want you to sing that song anymore. And of course, she said, why? And I didn't come at it with her in a shameful way or implying she'd done something wrong. I just said, I want you to know I don't want you to sing that. She said, why? And I said, well, the people who that song is supposedly about, Native American people have said that that song hurts them. It's an unkind song to Native American people. And she was like, oh my goodness, okay. And then she said, why would someone sing a song when someone had asked them not to? And I said, that's a great question. That's a question we could write the CD company and ask Disney why they made that song. And so that's an example of, not giving my 3-year-old yet heavy-handed history that she probably developmentally wasn't quite ready for even to be able to grasp, but also teaching her that actual living Native people who exist on this land base, who are still in the world, have said that's mean to us. And she got that. And that then has become a building block for further conversations about Native communities down the road.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Jennifer Harvey, and we're talking about her most recent book called Raising White Kids, Bringing Up Children in a Racially Unjust America. Now, Now, you talk about parental engagement with these anti-racism issues, but have we come very far teaching these subjects in schools?
No, we have not come far at all. You know, I remember, and my kids are at a wonderful public school. I love their teachers. And I remember my child coming home and talking about George Washington all over the place and never hearing her say a word about the fact that he had also participated in enslaving African people.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking as a parent, how do I and where do I enter to augment this history she's learning at school, tell her a more truthful version of it so that we can have a morally complicated discussion together about how do we think about figures like George Washington. And I think in our schools there are many, many reasons for this, but we do not give our kids the entire history, and we also don't support our children in navigating multiracial, interracial relationships very well in our schools. I think we kind of just hope that if we do a lot of diversity, things are just going to go fine without active teaching, and it's just simply not the case.
It's good. Do you have any remedies on how we can change that? Because it's so important, because the kids are not going to be staying in the parents' house, being influenced only by the family. And the schools should play a role in this.
Yes. Well, I think one of the things we need to do is, you know, especially white parents, when things are not going well at school for our children, we often are very able and quickly advocate for our kids. And I think one of the things white parents need to do is think about anti-racism as something that is a movement into schools, sort of push into our schools, that we should and can advocate for, just like we advocate for many other things quickly. And that's, of course, important for the well-being of children of color in our schools. But in fact, it's also important to the well-being of white kids. And so I think, you know, teachers can certainly, there's lots of guidance out there and curriculum out there that teachers can draw on to help themselves develop better practices, anti-racist pedagogies and teachings. But we also need parents to speak up, especially white parents. Parents of color are doing this all the time, and speak up, and for our teachers have their backs as they try and make those improvements, push our parent and teacher organizations to take these matters on as sort of a project that they care about, be going to the school board and asking how we're teaching our kids to do anti-racist diversity, you know, in an increasingly diverse society. And parents really could take this on as an issue, and we really need to. And that would help the school systems change, I think.
It's a huge missing link, as far as I can tell. The community that we live in Ithaca is somewhat segregated in many ways.
Yes.
Now, you have said that racial development is akin to physical, intellectual, and emotional development. Tell us about that.
So we know that kids develop emotionally over time, and it's not linear and it's not exactly chronological, but there are developmental kind of landmarks, and it's true for intellectual development as well, physical development. And I think more white parents need to realize that our kids develop racially. If we are living in a society where race is everywhere, all of our kids, regardless of their racial identity, go through a racial identity development process. And understanding that and understanding something about that, which is where lots of the work in raising white kids comes from, is being informed by these developmental models. There are practices and habits we can engage in with our children to enable healthier emotional development, stronger intellectual development, and better racial identity development. And so knowing what that arc can look like for white U.S. American children and youth is really important for parenting, because, again, if we're just silent, our kids are going to racially develop anyway, but they're going to develop in ways that we would not necessarily endorse if we have commitments to equality and justice. And if we know that kids racially develop and we know what some of those pathways look like, we can then also respond to some of those and intervene and support and mentor in the ways that our kids need us to do that if they're going to develop an anti-racist committed white identity.
Yeah, and you know, kids see so much racial injustice, shootings of young black men. All of this stuff is all over on the media.
Yes.
And schools are not dealing with it. That still astounds me.
Yes. And, you know, Dr. Beverly Daniel Tatum talks about racism being like smog in the air. I think a lot of times we don't think about this, that if I don't put a breathing mask on my child and I send her out into the world where toxins are in the air, those toxins become part of her body. And so if racism is like smog, which Dr. Tatum says it is, and I think she's correct, I'm basically, by not talking about race, by not talking about shootings with my kids, by not talking about the stuff that they do see in the world, they see it, I'm basically saying, well, not going to give her a breathing mask. I'm just going to send her out there and hope for the best. And it doesn't work.
Yeah.
It doesn't work.
Oh, God.
And so we can design breathing masks. And that's what I think race-conscious parenting is about a little bit, is how do we design really good breathing masks?
Yeah, yeah. Can you tell us, do you have any idea how much the Black Lives Matter movement has changed things, or has it?
Well, I mean, from my perspective, I think it's changed things radically. I mean, if we even look at the metric around the last, you know, presidential campaign where candidates were sort of not all of them able to even say Black Lives Matter, and now words like reparations are in the early, you know, floating around in the early primary campaign, I think Black Lives Matter movements all over the country really kind of threw down a moral and a political gauntlet that, you know, exposed and named a tension that exists in U.S. American society in somewhat of a similar way that Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. used to talk about. There's tensions in society that good activism exposes the tension and makes people have to wrestle with it and kind of take a side. I think Black Lives Matter really has done that in many, many local contexts and in the national conversation. And so, even though it's still very vexed and sometimes hostile moment in white communities engaging and thinking about Black Lives Matter as a movement, I think Black Lives Matter has just changed for the good ways that we are having to think about race in public spaces, and it's been very powerful in that regard. I mean, it's also in local context been powerful for actual other concrete wins on the ground, but it's just really changed the national conversation in ways that I certainly welcome.
Yeah, it feels like it's bringing certain parts of certain communities together too.
Yeah,
you know, you're seeing people marching you never used to see marching together, and I guess people need a premise on which to meet strangers, right?
Yeah, yeah. We need a premise on which to meet strangers.
Yeah, that's
what it feels
like.
And we need to meet those strangers because we need movements. We need to be organizing, and I think our kids need to see us organizing. And, you know, behind me thinking about parenting white children is me as an activist and organizer knowing that we've got to, all of us, be organizing and in activism together across all kinds of lines. And I want to be helping white parents raise children who are more ready and able to do that.
Yeah, that's a challenge in this culture, especially right now. I mean, it feels like things are regressing in some ways.
Yeah.
Tell us what your version is of a healthy white kid. What would he or she look like?
So, I mean, healthy in the context of a society that is deeply racially unjust and in which white supremacy runs rampant is a very complicated notion. I'm not sure any of us can be healthy till we've eradicated white supremacy, but I think it looks like a child who doesn't pretend not to see race, but, and this is kind of a paradox, also doesn't assume, just because they know someone is African American or know that someone is Chicana, they don't assume they know that person, right? They don't make assumptions based on race, but they notice and name race, right? It's also a child or a young person who is very comfortable in their own body. I don't want and think it's healthy for white youth to feel like, oh, I feel bad about being white, wallowing in white guilt, which can easily turn into into resentment is not a good, healthy space. Mm. I want you to support youth in being comfortable being in their own body, but also able to be respectful and honor truly diverse multiracial spaces, be comfortable functioning there, but not feel the need to dominate, not feel the need to sort of overinflate their own white presence there, but just to be comfortable in those spaces. And most importantly, healthy means a child or a young person or an adult for that matter who recognizes racism when they see it, assumes that it's normal and right to respond and intervene in racism when we see it, and a child who knows that they have the capacity and some skills for challenging and interrupting racism when it's happening, or knows, if they don't quite have the skills, they're able to talk about who the people in their lives are who will help them build those skills. They take it to those people as a moral dilemma they want some help figuring out. And so they know racism, and they are committed to anti-racism and are sort of seeing themselves as an agent who can be anti-racist.
Yeah, yeah. Now, you're a professor of religion at Drake University. Have you seen the religious communities coming out and dealing with some of these issues in better ways than perhaps in the past?
So, yes, especially since the 2016 election. In some ways, the 2016 election has created a real crisis moment, I think, for many religious communities, especially predominantly white Christian religious communities. And I've seen more white Christians publicly wrestling with our moral obligation and responsibility in light of, for example, the horrifying activities at the border, in light of the sort of unleashing of anti-black sentiment in the public sphere by politicians. I see white Christians in the Des Moines area, and we have a long way to go, but struggling to figure out and realizing there's a public witness that needs to be come out of those communities, given that, you know, what much of what we're seeing in the country is being sort of doused in sort of, you know, white Christian nationalist speak, if you will. So
oh, yes.
I've seen more of that. We have a long ways to go, but I do see people are troubled, and I think that it's right that they are troubled. And so I'm seeing folks try and connect through that and figure out what we need to be doing.
Yeah. Well, Jennifer, we are almost out of time. Just really quickly, can you tell us how you hope your book will change things or at least begin some kind of a dialogue in this country?
I hope that my book helps white folks who already feel like they're longing for a more just and equitable world to move from the, I just want that, but I don't know what to do point to the, oh, here's all these things, all these ways I could be taking action, and all these ways I could be taking action with my children that makes it less likely that my kids are going to grow up feeling as stuck as I might have felt as a 30-year-old white American. That's one of my biggest hopes for the book.
Oh, great. It's really a fascinating book. I hope people will go out and buy it. And again, I've been talking to Jennifer Harvey. Her book is called Raising White Kids, Bringing Up Children in a Racially Unjust America. And I thank you so much, Jenna, for joining us.
Tish, thanks for having me on the program.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.